cooperation over chaos. We are all in this together.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Hour. As always, we'd like to start off by acknowledging that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people, the land that they've nurtured for tens of thousands of years before it was stolen. We're broadcasting from stolen land, land that was never ceded, always was and always will be First Nations land. They had a strong focus on do no harm, and that applied to their communities and to their country. And in the process of doing that over tens of thousands of years, they've accumulated a great amount of ancient wisdom, the same wisdom that we're going to need as we navigate the climate crisis.
A bike shop owner here in Geelong told me the other day that where he used to sell one bike a week, maybe, he now sells one a day. That's what's happening. When petrol becomes expensive and unreliable, well, people adjust. So they take shorter trips in their cars and they shift from their cars to bikes, to e-bikes, or simply start walking or take the bus, public transport. But the biggest shift maybe is happening with our cars themselves. You know, EVs, electric vehicles, are now clearly the cheaper and the safer option. And EV sales have doubled compared to last year. So that combined with, you know, solar panels and home batteries booming, I don't know, why is everyone complaining? Oh, it's so terrible how the petrol prices have gone up. No, it's not terrible. It's really good. It's making all this happen. It's actually making us change our ways. Imagine if petrol had become more expensive because of some new climate tax from the government. Ooh, there would have been a lot of angry resistance and people complaining, upheaval. But the way it's happening now, it's only revealing two things. One, how the fossil fuels have made us vulnerable. Two, how greedy the fossil fuel companies are. They have absolutely no problem with, at this time when prices are going up and so on, they're raking in profits. BP, for instance, have more than doubled their profits in the first quarter of this year. They had $3,200 million of profit. That's $3.2 billion in profit at the expense of us, the consumers. Everyone who bought their petrol at BP Servo have contributed to that they have doubled their profit. I don't think we want to or need to depend on petrol, or oil, or gas for that matter, any longer. We can move to electricity. It's cheaper, it's better for our lungs, and it's the obvious choice. However, today in the Sustainable Hour, we're going to talk about something else that is really, really deeply important, I believe, our democracy. And what does democracy have to do with our failing ability to deal with the climate crisis? But before that, it's time now for our global news, delivered as always by Colin Mockett, OAM, who has had an eye on during the week what's happening out there in the big world. So, Colin, let's hear what you have for us today.
Yes, thank you, Mick. And it does link to what you've been talking about there, because my roundup this week begins with news from Northern Europe, that is Finland and the UK. From Finland came a report this week from the Centre for Research on Energy and Clean Air, which disclosed that since the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, much of the demand for oil from Singapore, Brunei, and Malaysian refineries is now being met by oil from Russia. Now, that's oil that was previously barred from dealing through the world because of sanctions that were imposed after Russia invaded the Ukraine. Now, if those names of the countries appeared familiar, Singapore, Brunei and Malaysia, they were the countries visited by Anthony Albanese 2 weeks ago to shore up Australia's fuel supplies. So it's almost certain that Australian motorists are not only paying extra for their fuel these days, but they're now almost certainly using Russian-sourced petrol and diesel that would have been illegal because of the sanctions prior to the Iran conflict. Meanwhile, in the UK, tomorrow, the British have local elections throughout the nation. Now, like us and many other countries in the wake of the Trump re-election, the Brits have find themselves mistrusting all politicians, most especially their two leading parties. They're all on the nose. Unlike us, they have a Trump-leaning right-wing party in Nigel Farage's Reform. That's the equivalent of our Pauline Hanson's One Nation. Now, the Reform Party is tipped to do well tomorrow, as the major parties in the UK are very much out of favour. But so too, tipped to do well tomorrow, are the Greens, which are polling very strongly with pre-poll voters. When they exit the voting and they take the who did you vote for of the pre-poll. So governments around the world, most especially here in Victoria, will be looking at Britain, which is a nationwide election of local governments, to decide which way it's going to swing, either right or left, but it certainly isn't going to stay in the middle with the Starmer government. Now to China, where according to an analysis from Carbon Brief, the World Organization, China's emissions fell by 1% in the final quarter of 2025, and that means that it has officially flatlined. All told, coal-fired emissions in China declined by 0.3%, and that's a significant transformation for China, which accounts for roughly one-third of global CO2 emissions, more than any other country. To put it into context, Chinese coal-fired emissions have increased every year for the past 40 years, during which time the country transitioned from a third world economy to become the world's leading manufacturing economy. But it is now, without a doubt, the world leader, China, to overtake an America, Trump's America, which has, become much more insular. Now, up until now, all of China's progress has been fueled by coal-generated power, with most of the coal coming from Australia, but not anymore. The shift is now being driven and sustained by China's unparalleled clean energy expansion into wind and solar. They are the world's leading suppliers of wind and solar hardware. And the new figures show that China is now the world's largest clean energy investor in its own economy, not just fueling every other nation. It's now the largest in its own economy. Now, hard on the heels of the Chinese figures came a report that analyzes electricity data from 215 countries and 13 geographic and economic groupings, such as Africa, Asia, Latin America, the EU, and the G7. This data dives deep into the seven countries and regions with the highest electricity demand, which accounts for 72% of global electricity demand. China once more led the solar build-out, recording more than half of the global increase in both solar capacity and solar generation during last year, 2025. Now, this pushed the share of solar and wind in China's generation mix to 22%, which surpassed the OECD average of 20%. But India also ramped up clean power deployment. Renewable generation growth doubled in India. It doubled its previous record. And for the first time, India installed more new solar capacity than the United States did. And then another global milestone, renewables overtook coal power in 2025. Solar, wind and hydropower and other renewable sources together contributed more than a third of global electricity generation for the first time in the modern power system. Conversely, the share of coal power dropped below a third for the first time in history. The accelerating build-up of solar power is increasingly taking place alongside battery storage deployment, which is enabling the next paradigm shift from daytime solar to anytime solar. Battery costs fell sharply for the second consecutive year. In 2024, battery costs dropped 20%. In 2025, they fell a further 45%. Frontrunners such as Chile and Australia installed enough grid battery storage to shift over 50% of new solar generation in 2025 and are already seeing benefits in lower power prices and reduced curtailment. And on Australia, it was announced this week that batteries overtook coal and gas to become Australia's dominant price setter in the March quarter of this year, driving a fall in wholesale electricity prices and accelerating a structural shift in the power market. Average prices across the national electricity market fell to $73 per megawatt hour. That's down 12% from the year previous, as batteries set prices in about 32% of dispatch intervals. That's the first time that storage has led the market. The shift follows a rapid build-out of capacity, with more than 4,400 megawatts added over the past year, allowing batteries to absorb excess solar during the day and discharge it into the evening peaks. The numbers point to a turning point for Australia's energy transition. Batteries are no longer a marginal technology, but a central force that's shaping our prices, displacing fossil fuels and redefining how electricity is traded throughout Australia during the daytime. The rise of storage is also accelerating the decline of coal-fired generation, where output in Australia fell to a new quarterly low, while gas generation dropped to its weakest level in more than two decades, as batteries and renewables meet a greater share of demand. Renewables supplied 46.5% of Australia's total generation during the first quarter of this year. That's a new record, and that's thanks to strong gains in both solar and wind output. That increase on low-cost supply was a key driver of lower average prices, particularly overnight when higher wind generation displaced coal-fired power. And finally, news of the world's greenest sports team, Forest Green Rovers. The Rovers lost 1-0 against Boreham Wood in the National League playoff eliminator last weekend. Following that defeat, they don't have any further matches in the competition. However, the Rovers women's team, they won against Poole Ladies 1-0 and are currently top of their division, which is the Southwest Regional Women's Football League Premier Division. That's the fifth tier of the national competition. And they are now firmly in line for promotion. And that little bit of mixed sports news ends my roundup for the week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Our guest today is Professor Joseph Cavalieri. He's Professor Emeritus at La Trobe University, and he's also convener of the movement Conversations at the Crossroads. So, Joe, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about the man who is Joseph Camilleri, and I guess that you want to particularly talk about the event that's happening on May 9 in Melbourne.
Well, I don't know that you want to hear too much about me, but I have been teaching at universities. I'm retired formally from teaching at La Trobe University, but at various universities I've taught for 43 years, and my field is international relations, but touching on many issues, including intercultural dialogue, relations with Asia, the political landscape in Australia, and quite a lot more. And I have been engaged in various forms of public life for now close to 60 years. So, Conversation at the Crossroads is the most recent, and it is something we got together with a number of others approximately 6 years ago. Lots of events and activities during this time, and we're now gearing up for undoubtedly the largest project we've attempted so far, which is reclaiming democracy together, and which, as you've suggested, we are launching Saturday the 9th of May.
That's a really excellent introduction, Joseph, and it's piqued my interest in so many areas. Why now, and why reclaiming democracy? Have we lost democracy in Australia?
Well, Australia is but an outpost, or has been until now, an outpost of the Western world. What happens in Australia usually reflects trends and events in other parts of the world, in particular the Western world, Europe and North America, the US in particular. So what we're seeing here, a bit later and not quite as pronounced as the events unfolding in the US and Europe at the moment, but nevertheless in the same direction, is something that's been underway for a considerable period of time, and that is the gradual decaying, unravelling of the democratic idea. So that now, and for some little time, we are reduced to thinking about democracy just as something you do once every few years when you cast a vote for this person, usually that party or the other party, which then doesn't lead to very much, doesn't influence a great deal. The revolving doors of which political party coming in or going out makes relatively little difference, and the big decisions are made without much reference to the vast majority of people who voted one way or another. So that's where we're at, with many other things happening that are cause for concern. There are two aspects. There are things that are palpably wrong with what we see around us. Not just the powerlessness that people feel, but the lack of information about what decisions are being made, how they're arrived at, and who's influenced them. If you look at any of the major issues, that information is withheld from the public. And of course, in the absence of information about what's happening, why decisions are being made and who's making them, it's impossible to be informed, and informed well enough to be able to participate in serious discussion of the issues, let alone to be part of the decisions that are made. So I think it's fair to say that in much of the Western world, and we are seeing it in Australia too in various ways, democracy is in trouble, deep trouble. And so our project, our idea, is to try and recover the fundamental ideas which have inspired the great democratic projects in human history. And for us, important right. examples are, of course, the Athenian model of well over 24 centuries ago, and then the more recent attempts following the English, French, and US revolutions, and more generally the Enlightenment project, which got going in earnest in the 18th century. Now, if you look at the ideas that were developed in relation to these two experiments in human history, there is really very little to connect those ideas with what passes for democracy now.
Our program is called The Sustainable Hour, and we talk about sustainable issues. I'd love to hear and listen to you for ages about the way that democracy has been eroded over the course of the last 10 or 15 years. But could I ask you to focus a little bit more on how this is operating in the political world as regarding to climate change?
Well, that's a classic example of the failure of democracy. Climate change we've known about for a long time, and other environmental problems that have been emerging steadily, in fact, from the 19th century onwards. People knew about climate change, those who bothered to find out, for the best part of 100 years. It's not new. It's got a lot worse, of course, as time has gone on. So there are several aspects to it. The possibility, if not the reality, of environmental collapse and decision making. And one of the main reasons why it has come to this unpleasant state of affairs, when you look at all the environmental problems we're confronted with, of which climate change is, of course, perhaps the most serious, is that vested interests, the interests that have largely shaped the industrial project beginning in the 18th century, and the development of fossil fuel industries, the vested interests that have accumulated, and financial interests that go with them, and other interests associated with them, including military interests. The reality is that the military is now the single most important contributor to carbon emissions in the world today. 18% of the world's carbon emissions are directly connected one way or another with the activities of the military, whether in peacetime or wartime. The use of fossil fuels in the production process, the transport of materials on a colossal scale. We are talking about, as you probably know, the current US military budget, just the US alone, is approaching 1.1, 1.2, and it's projected to rise to 1.5 trillion, which means 1,500 billion per year. Now, you have to ask yourself, where do many of these dollars go? Well, a substantial proportion, other than salaries for people, civilian and military, it is the production, transport, movement, use of these machines, of these weapons of war. And then, of course, you have to also ask yourself, what do the hundreds of thousands of people associated with military infrastructure, who get their incomes from that, what do they do with their incomes? That's a separate question. It is a production consumption on a massive scale, and that's one of the realities, and not talked about enough, which is a shame. All these are major decisions to which only a relatively small group of people are contributing, and usually it is geared to the preservation of entrenched interests. And politicians come and go, political parties gain government and then go into opposition. But for one reason or another, would dare not take on these interests head on. Would not. And that's the reality in which we live. So the climate, the sustainability of the planet is put in danger by the short-term, relatively short-term interests of certain privileged groups and a political class that basically is incapable of dealing with that problem head-on. So the challenges confronting the quest for sustainability is inseparable from the challenge posed by a decaying democracy in our world today, in particularly in the advanced industrial Western world. And that raises one other big, big question. One of the reasons why these issues that we're discussing are able to confront us so relentlessly is that too often the social movements that are beavering away on so many different issues, whether it be environmental issues, peace and war issues, social justice issues, economic inequality, housing, mental health, and 100 and other things, operate in silos. Operate in silos. They may think a little bit occasionally about the other issues. They may even see some connection, but there's very little by way of connecting of issues, let alone connecting of people, let alone connecting of organizations around common interests. And that's exactly what the powers of be would like to see. Disconnection, insulated, operating in silos. And they laugh all the way to the bank.
Is that what May 9 is essentially about then? Trying to get those people looking at their similarities rather than their differences and working together post-May 9?
Yes, very much. And that's where democracy comes into it. Because if there is a stumbling block, I mean, there are so many groups, including so many movements, that are able to master considerable resources, human resources, and yet are not making, take the environmental movement, the headway that one would have thought should be possible by now. And even when you have a few successes here and there, they are often followed by reverses, backsliding. And that is because all of these groups, in one way or another, hit a stumbling block. They're banging their heads against the same brick wall, all of them. But unfortunately, they don't come together to make progress in getting through that brick wall. And so we would very much like to see much more consultation and collaboration between a number, many progressive movements, and hopefully the project as it unfolds will create spaces where this begins to be thought of as an important objective and hopefully acted upon.
Hey, Joseph, who is meeting on May the 9th? Where, and is it open to the public?
Yes, well, we are meeting at the Melbourne Town Hall on May the 9th for a reason. Why May the 9th? And the reason, of course, is that that was the day, May the 9th, when the Parliament of Australia was officially opened 125 years ago. So it's the 125th anniversary. It was done with great pomp and ceremony, It's a extraordinary piece of Australian history. 12,000 attended, each invited by the monarch. They came from all parts of Australia.
Who's attending on May the 9th at the Town Hall?
It was open to the public. We've chosen the Town Hall as the most obvious central point for an indoor event. And fortunately or unfortunately, registrations for attendance in person have closed because we've reached capacity, but people still have every possibility to register online. That's not a problem. I can't tell you precisely who's coming, but I think they're coming, obviously, from all parts of Melbourne and different parts of Victoria. A few are coming interstate, and I think there may be the odd one coming from overseas.
And who's leading the debates?
Who's speaking? Well, I'll just name a couple. Professor Gillian Triggs is one of our speakers. She was the president of the Australian Human Rights Commission for something like 7 or 8 years. She's a leading scholar of law, and she has held various positions, and most recently she assumed a role at the United Nations on question of protection for those whose rights are in jeopardy. And she's back now in Australia, and she's an eminent figure both in the academic world and in public life. So she will presumably be talking about the relevance of human rights and of law in the way people go about reaching decisions and deliberating the big issues of our time. Another one will be Professor John Keane, who is, I would think, the leading theorist or historian of democracy in this country, and indeed has a very important international reputation. And I'll just name a third one, and that'll do. We have been privileged to secure the contribution of Professor Wendy Brown from the United States, who in my view is the leading scholar on democracy, certainly in the United States, and one of the leading scholars anywhere in the world, who is making major contributions to our understanding of democracy and its need to adapt to the modern world, and this will be of interest to you, and how we integrate care for planet Earth as one of the foundational principles of democratic deliberation and decision-making. She has developed this at a very high level of intellectual depth, but has this extraordinary ability to relate it to people who perhaps have hardly ever read a book or anything else, and make very complex ideas readily understandable. Widely sought after speaker, and we're very pleased to have her with us. There will be some others. One whose health is in question a little bit, so that's a little bit of a question mark, is Francesca Albanese, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine, and very controversial in some quarters. Anyhow, and we will have an opening welcome by the Mayor of the City of Melbourne, Nick Rees.
Listeners, you've got the Sustainable Hour podcast. At the moment, we're listening to Professor Joseph Camilleri, and specifically about the event, looking at democracy, the true nature of democracy on May 9. Jane Morton has just joined us, And maybe your thoughts, Jane, on what's happening.
Hi, everyone. So I'm part of a new campaign that's starting up called Beyond Billionaires. We initially called it Tax Wealth Not Work, following on from Gary Stevenson's tour, The People's Economist. I'm very excited about it because I think that we're at one of those moments where there's a wave of momentum building. I think you can see it in the debate around the budget, where people like Conrad from Punters Politics are on the news every night talking about the need to tax gas. You know, like I think until very recently we've had neoliberalism just dominating sort of the messaging, and people have just been brainwashed with this idea that, you know, we've got to privatise everything, that you've got to, you know, decrease tax on the wealthy because it'll trickle down somehow. And I think suddenly the narrative is changing and we have this incredible opportunity to look at a redistribution of wealth, which I think is absolutely essential, but also to look, as I'm sure Joseph has been saying, to look at restoring democracy. So one of the things that we're arguing for, campaigning for, is actually a citizens' assembly on the redistribution of wealth. What we think is that that we're in this vicious cycle where as billionaires just have more and more money, so much money, as Gary Stevenson says, so much money they actually can't spend it on any kind of life, you know, any kind of living, no matter how extravagant. Even if they're buying, you know, private jets and things, they still can't spend it. So they're pretty much forced to buy houses, land, resources, media outlets, and basically what we've seen, of course, is they also buy politicians, buy political parties. So we're in this terrible bind where the ultra, ultra wealthy are getting wealthier and wealthier. We've got Musk heading for being a trillionaire, like it's just unimaginable. And as they have more and more influence on the media and on politicians, it gets harder and harder to change because the disinformation and the vicious campaigns against any politician that tries to change things are just getting stronger and stronger. So what we think is that, you know, if we could actually get a citizens' assembly, that might break the deadlock. But even campaigning for it is starting to change that narrative around the idea that we can just trust these politicians totally under the thumb of vested interests, or whether we need more people power, basically. So it's basically a win-win either way. If we get the Citizens' Assembly, that'll be great. If we don't, we're just raising awareness of the need for a complete reboot of democracy.
Joe, does that fit in with your plans for the day?
The question of economic inequality is a crucial aspect of democratic thought, democratic thinking. The commitment to democratic deliberation and decision-making. I mean, let's face it, in Australia today, this is very much in line with what Jane was saying, we have something, maybe a little under 200 billionaires, hard to estimate, but around that figure, perhaps a little less, perhaps a little more. And on average, each one earns $87,000 an hour. $87,000 an hour. And at the same time, 2.5 million people are suffering from food insecurity. And the children amongst them are struggling to have one reasonable meal a day. The same Australia, the same. Now, the question, the obvious point to make, it's so obvious one feels a bit ridiculous about making it, can you imagine the disparity of influence? The household with two children suffering from food insecurity along the lines I've described, the influence they are able to bring to bear to major decisions, and the influence of the person who earns $87,000 an hour. When you're at that level, you just pick up the phone and speak to the Prime Minister directly when you want to. It doesn't matter whether he's flying to the US. If you want to, you speak to him. And to any other minister. Just think of the beggars in many of our streets in Melbourne. How could they do that? I mean, it's the difference, the disparity is so glaring that to talk of political equality, which is supposed to be one of the principles of democracy, is just nonsense. So unless you have a substantial reduction in economic inequality and disadvantage, you can't even begin to approximate equality of political influence. So that has to be remedied.
Jane's solution is citizens' assembly. Does that fit in with your view of democracy?
We're very keen to explore citizen assembly. In fact, we did run a little experiment last year. We called it citizen assembly, in which we were discussing the pros and cons of the proposal to establish a nuclear power industry in Australia. But the catch with that is, who's calling it and what happens with the outcome of its deliberations? That's the critical point. If a government were to call a citizen assembly, you can bet your bottom dollar it'd be a waste of time, because it would be vested interests controlling the process and framing the question, and so on and so on. If it were just a civil society initiative, it would be very useful, very interesting, assume it's well done, very useful, etc. But it's only when very large numbers would be able to attend such an assembly or series of assemblies that it can be reasonably expected to have an impact. So what we're interested in doing is to see whether over time, it'll take a little while, we can scale up the number taking part in, I prefer to call it, a convocation of the people. And using the latest technologies, assuming we remain in control of how they're used, ideally, even if we could only reach, which is a small proportion of the total current voting population, which is getting close to 18 million, even if we could only involve 500,000, that would be a significant step. And once, of course, you've got to the 1 or 2 million, I can rest assured the powers that be will be getting rather jittery. So, citizen assembly, yes. There are tools already that exist which would enable hundreds of groups to be meeting simultaneously or at different times and connecting with each other. But it'll take time to introduce that, to find the resources necessary to keep it going, and to prepare. It needs a lot of preparation. What happens in such a convocation of people? They need to be relatively well informed. That's one. There's another principle of democracy that's not well understood. You do not come to the democratic table to push your personal private interest. You don't. Rousseau told us that. He called it the general will, not the mass of competing wills or globules of desire. It's the general will, the general good, which now must also include the general good of the earth. So you come to see what's best for the nation, for your community, if it's only a local community you're looking at, for this, what we call states in Australia, for the nation, for the region, for the world. You don't come to say, I don't want this building to go up, it hides the sun, impedes my view. And that's all I'm interested in. I come to win this thing. So there's a lot of work to be done, but yes, the notion of people coming together, deliberating, and making important decisions, some people call it citizen assembly, it can be called other things, is something we need to keep exploring and developing.
this week's Sustainable Hour is quickly running out, and it appears to me this is such an important discussion. Luckily, we know that it's continuing on the 9th of May, where everyone can join online, but also after that. So just as we are rounding off the hour, first you, Jane, a little bit also about if people want to participate in the Citizens Assembly that you talk about, where's the connection point? Where do we, is there a website? How do people find you? And the same to you, Joseph. What's happening next? But Jane first.
Thank you. Look, what the Citizens Assembly we would be pushing for is one set up in the same style as the Irish ones that were the ones that led to successful referendums on gay marriage and abortion reform, abortion law reform. So they are like a jury where you randomly select a stratified sample that represents the population. They're usually only 100, not hundreds of thousands. They have been extremely successful overseas in breaking deadlocks. So people can't volunteer to be part of them because they would be set up by an independent agency where they would have access to independent experts. They'd be able to request other experts. They would have time to deliberate over many days. And what experience shows overseas, and they're used a lot in Europe, is that people who are set, who are invited to deliberate on behalf of the greater good and the whole population take their responsibility very seriously and come up with very good solutions. Of course, it's best if it's set up with prior agreement by the government, not influenced by the government, but prior agreement by the government that they're going to pay attention to the recommendations. That is quite possible. If it wasn't set up by the government, we would have to try and fund it ourselves, and it would be hundreds of thousands of dollars, but that's not impossible. But anyway, you can't volunteer to be part of that. But we would love you to be part of our campaign. It is so brand new that we don't even have a website yet. But we do have a sign-up form. So it would be a matter of going to bit.ly/taxwealthoz, A-U-S, taxwealthoz. I'm sure it'll be in the program notes somewhere.
Jane, maybe an easier way of saying it is, keep listening to the Sustainable Hour. We'll keep you posted and tell people how they connect with you as you progress.
That's a great idea. And we will have a website like literally within a week, which will be called Beyond Billionaires. It won't be that hard to find.
And Joseph, after the 9th of May, what can we expect from your group and what's going to be the big vision in the coming years?
Well, at the moment, we are thinking of a 7-year project. Of course, that does not mean that things will come to an end at the end of the 7-year period or that all that needs to be done will have been done. Far from it. But at least in terms of what a project getting off the ground at this time, we think it's reasonable to think of 3 stages. The first stage, which might take us 2 years, 2.5 years, give or take, we see as demonstrating the feasibility of the idea of introducing radical approach to democracy, radical in the sense that it's going back to the roots of the idea, the roots, radical. That's the Latin word for root. Back to the fundamentals of democracy with some adaptation to take account of development. And we see operating on three areas. One is education for democracy. There's a lot to be done in terms of raising the level of understanding about what democracy involves and how you can approach it and what can be done about it. Education for democracy, both in formal institutions and in general community education. The second prong is to try and connect with the many, many groups, socially progressive groups working on a range of issues, to create space where they can come together, small numbers, larger numbers, to discuss areas of common interests, possibly to consult, and where possible to collaborate. That's going to be a very important and aspect of the work. And there is a question involved in that. How can you expect an entire population or even a substantial cross-section of the population to engage in democratic decision-making and deliberation at this very complex level called the national level, where you never, never experience it in your everyday life. And that's why we have to ask, are environmental groups, social justice groups, trade unions, professional associations themselves as democratic as they could be? Could more be done so that decisions are the result of the deliberation of all members and supporters of a given group, more effectively, more meaningfully than is currently the case? And the third area is to try to bring people together in assemblies, well-prepared, well-informed, to discuss major issues and contentious issues, whether it is the quick phasing out of fossil fuels, or whether it is the doing away of military alliances, etc., 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 and see how the discussion emerges and whether people have the capacity to relate to each other in a respectful, informed, and effective dialogue. That's going to be a crunch part of the project as it unfolds, we hope, over the next 2 to 3 years.
Can I just briefly comment? I hope at this point in history that it's actually not going to be so hard to bring left and right together on this. And I think a really interesting development, you know, if you look at the people who voted for Trump, they thought they were going to drain the swamp. They thought they were going to have no more wars. We've seen a very strange and surprising thing happen, which is that the United Australia Party and One Nation have just signed on to the gas tax idea. Like, I think that the right-wing populists have been riding the same wave that we want to ride, which is profound dissatisfaction with democracy and with the so-called cost of living crisis, which is the increasing wealth inequality crisis. So I think, you know, we have to really seize the moment. I think we can. I think we're seeing very surprising developments, you know, just happening, unfolding around the world, not just in Australia in recent months.
We have come to the famous B section of the Sustainable Hour, where we're looking for an alternative to being the change. We used to say be the change, then we started saying be the difference. What should we be after a discussion like this one we have had today? Jane, do you have a suggestion?
We should be optimistic. That I've always thought to win on the climate, like, you know, 20 years of campaigning on the climate can be sort of depressing, but I've always thought we need to, that to win anything, we need to win everything. Because the stumbling block has always been that democracy, like they've known since Greek times, that real democracy is actually randomly selected people rather than elected people, because when you get elected people, you get vested interests and wealthier people controlling those elected people. So we're at a moment, I think, where we can transform democracy and change everything. You know, have ordinary people that agree so we don't have great big wars, have ordinary people agree so we don't wreck the planet, have ordinary people agree so that we redistribute wealth. Nobody needs $1 billion. Nobody. You can't spend it in a lifetime, even if you try. So redistribution of wealth is sort of the key that unlocks everything else.
Joseph, what would you say we should be?
Well, I wouldn't say we should be optimistic, because there are really very few grounds for optimism, to be absolutely clear. But we can be hopeful. And hope arises as people come together, link up their skills, their energies, their aspirations to a worthwhile vision, objective, and that's what empowers. And sure enough, in the past, at different times, people coming together have created a lot of important changes for the better. We've gone through a period when there has been considerable disillusionment, disempowerment, and the question is whether we can turn that around. And there are forces at work which are trying to take advantage of the disempowerment and the disillusionment, and that is the task of extremist groups, many of them of the far right, who sense that as an opportunity of a lifetime, who will mouth a few progressive slogans, just like the fascists did in 1920s and early 30s Europe. And we have to be careful. So we have to bring together people, have serious conversations. Some of them may be difficult conversations, but it's very important to have these conversations before things get out of hand. So there's a lot to do. The risks are very considerable, but so are the opportunities. And I think it is the spiritual dimension of hope which takes us forward and might make it possible for us to minimize the risks and maximize the opportunities.
I think you can count that one as a be informed and be open for change.
Be hopeful and be optimistic.
We're out on the street where new voices have risen. We first ask a question and then we listen.
We've had enough of the old games they play, of power and lies, of silence, of looking away. We are the difference. We feel the heartbeat. We are the nation. And finances is difference. For the love we see with the temperature of humanity.
Tapping into people's fear, scaring them. You know, that's what these right-wing proxies for the Liberal Party, etc. are relying upon.
So step back, you proxies, we're calling you out. We will be holding you to account. This is no longer a fight between left and right. This fight is between democracy and authoritarianism under the false banner of grassroots activism. I don't care if you call me woke, just because I'm actually empathetic and care about helping people. If that's what woke is, then I'm all for that. I stand firm and support where I can. I'm not giving up, I can tell you that. Old parties crumble, the truth breaks through. Real grassroots rising, growing fast. Misinformation, intimidation. We meet the proxies with determination. We are the difference. We feel the heartbeat. We are the nation. And finances is difference. For the love we see with the temperature of humanity.
We have the playbooks that they're using, and we cannot allow these billionaire-backed propaganda machines to intimidate and corrode our democracy. Corrode our democracy.
Dark to light, write it down, call it out. Every fear, every fight, intimidation is a disgrace. We are the difference. We feel the heartbeat. We are the nation. And finances is difference. For the love we see with the temperature of humanity.
To vote, not to be bullied, please step back. Intimidation isn't democracy, it's a disgrace.
We are the difference.
Why are you trying to scare voters instead of trusting them to choose for themselves? I have the right to vote free from harassment. Please step back.
We are the difference. We kill your heartbeat and the nation. Protect each other and our humanity.
Please step back.